Case number 08-1071, National Telephone Cooperative Association Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Ms. Guillory for the petitioner, Mr. Marcus for the respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Marie Guillory representing NTCA. Your Honors, the FCC has published a final analysis in this case that does not contain the components required by Section 604 and that does not meet the reasonable good faith standard articulated in the cases the FCC relies upon, Associated Fisheries and Little Bay Lobster. In Associated Fisheries, the court found that the agency met the reasonable good faith test because it explicitly considered numerous alternatives, adopted some measures, and explained its reasons for rejecting others. In Little Bay, the agency set forth in detail the reasons for adopting a new rule altering fishing boundaries. And the Little Bay lobster fishermen had not pointed to any facts to show a dramatic impact from the rule. In environmental defense, the adequacy of the final analysis was not at issue because the EPA was not required to publish a final analysis after finding that its rule would not impact a significant number of small entities. This case is more like southern offshore fishing, where the court found that the agency started out on the wrong course by not preparing an initial analysis and then just stuck to its wrong course and found that there was no significant impact.
Well, why is it sticking to a wrong course? Initially, it didn't do anything, and then it does the analysis. And that's not sticking to the wrong course. Seems to me it responded to the remand order.
Well, Your Honor, it has taken the wrong course because of it has failed to comply with each of the requirements of Section 604, Section 604.2 and Section 604.5 are the two components that it has not complied with. In addition, it has not given serious consideration to the alternatives or proposed or to the significant economic burdens imposed by its rule. Section 2 of the RFA, which is the findings portion of the statute, says that agencies are required to solicit and consider flexible regulatory proposals and explain the rationale for their actions to assure that such proposals are given serious consideration.
You agree, of course, that the statute doesn't set forth a substantive standard. It's merely
procedural. No quarrel with that, Your Honor. It's not a substantive standard. It's a procedural requirement. However, it's not a meaningless exercise, and it's not a rote exercise either.
Can I ask about what that means, that it's not a procedural requirement? So it seems to me there's two ways for you to attack what happened here. One is procedural, that is, under the RFA, certain requirements weren't met. And the other is the one that we established in Allied Local, that once statements are made in an RFA, they are subject to APA review in the ordinary way in which any other statement, including whether the agency's explanation is reasonable, whether it's arbitrary, capricious, considers the alternatives, et cetera. Are you making, I frankly cannot tell from the briefs, are you making only the first argument that this is a procedural RFA problem, or are you making both arguments that the APA's arbitrary and capricious analysis is violated?
Your Honor, I'm making both arguments.
So then it isn't just procedural. You're also making the argument that the government's response is arbitrary, which has a substantive level to it, a minimal substantive level, but nonetheless a substantive level. Is that right?
The substantive level, however, Your Honor, does not go to the merits of the rule.
Well, does it go to the? I see. It only goes to the reasonableness of their explanation.
That's correct,
and their
Your
consideration
Honor.
Of alternatives.
It goes to the question of whether or not they exercised reasonable good faith, which is the standard.
Well, it's not our standard. That happens to be another circuit's.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I don't understand why both sides are citing First and Fifth Circuit cases when we have about 10 decisions in our own circuit. We don't. It's clear that whichever way you word this, your argument is that the explanations offered are not reasonable under the APA standard, and that they haven't considered alternatives sufficiently. That's your kind of argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the reasonableness argument also, they ignored relevant data. In addition, I mean, they didn't base their decision on the record.
Let me add, when you say you don't consider the merits, so the FCC's ultimate bottom line statement here is that the problems caused to your clients simply do not outweigh the public interest of making this rule. And in particular, they point to a section of the statute which seems to me quite difficult for you. It's a section that says that all local exchange carriers have a duty to provide, to the extent technically feasible, number portability, right? And you don't doubt that this is technically feasible, do you?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
You don't think it's technically feasible? I understand it might cost money. Do you think it's not technically feasible?
Your Honor, there was in the record evidence of technical infeasibility as well as a cost burden.
But I didn't see, is that in your argument? Because that seems like a merits argument, not an RFA argument. Are you arguing that it was unreasonable for the agency to conclude that number portability was technically feasible?
We're not there. I mean, we're basically saying that what they should have done was to consider the burden imposed by the new rule.
Right, but that's not a question of technical feasibility. That's a question of burden.
Well, the technical infeasibility was part of a burden. I mean,
as a matter of the science, is it not possible to do this? You don't make that argument.
It's possible to do it, but it imposes
cost.
Yeah. And that's the burden part, and that's what the agency had the obligation to consider, the serious economic burdens. And then having considered those based on the record, and we contend that they didn't base their consideration on the record, that they ignored the data, that they relied on mischaracterizations of the data by Verizon Wireless and CTIA instead of looking at the data and coming up with a rational conclusion, that their so-called range of lower end of the range was a concoction. They didn't really explain that they had chosen the lower end of the range. Footnote 13 is hardly an explanation for having chosen the lower end of the range. In addition to that, there were alternatives presented by NTCA and other carriers, two of them, and those were not dissected, explained, or considered seriously, which is what it should have done.
What about the argument about the FCC acting unreasonable by not considering transport costs because they were deferred to another proceeding? Now, that issue was raised originally. Was not raised. It was in the original intermodal order, wasn't challenged. And then Central Texas, at least with respect to wireless, we approved. In what way is wireline to wireless different with respect to that issue, that is, the deferring of the issue to another proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, to begin with, we don't contend that they could not defer the transport issue. You know, they have the discretion to defer the issue. However, in doing the analysis, when they consider significant burdens, to the extent that those significant burdens are brought to their attention and transport costs were brought to their attention, they have an obligation to consider the impact of that burden and then figure out whether or not the alternative that is suggested, and in this case the suggested alternative was that point of interconnection be established in small company areas or that transport costs be paid.
But they did discuss that exact point in the intermodal also, right? The idea of moving of making that requirement before permitting portability. They discussed and they said that would destroy the whole point, that it wouldn't be possible to do this. So you could, I guess what I'm wondering is how much of this is, should we regard as having been forfeited by not having been raised before? Both of those issues, the problem of where the point is and the problem of the deferral to another proceeding, you could have raised earlier. And some people did raise earlier. That is, in the wireless to wireless, people did raise it earlier. Why isn't that forfeited? Why is it? It didn't just arise. I mean, it didn't just arise because of the filing of the RFA. This is something you knew was happening.
It didn't, Your Honor. But the point of the RFA and the purpose is to consider alternatives, another solution to the transport issue could have been considered in the RFA apart from the merits. And that's what the FCC failed to do.
You say the point is to consider alternatives, but didn't they consider the alternatives? I mean, it seems to me your real objection, to go back to this procedure substance thing, is that the substantive outcome reached by the agency was unreasonable given the state of the evidence presented to it. No?
Your Honor, we're not attacking the substance of the intermodal order, but the...
Then I'm not sure what you're left with, because they certainly did consider. It's very tough for a court, as you know, to review whether an agency considered something.
Well, there's consider and there's seriously consider, right? I mean, there's consider, and then there's also, to the extent that they are required to follow the APA, there's considering the record. There's looking at the entire record instead of picking out bits and pieces mm-hmm. of the record that are not relevant.
That more goes to the reasonable explanation, I suppose.
It does, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert.
I'll reserve.
May it please the court, Joel Marcus from the FCC. This case does come before the court in an unusual procedural posture, which is that in the typical case, the RFA analysis and the order are joined together and they're both before the court at the same time. But I think that the cleavage between the RFA analysis and the substantive order that the RFA analysis is analyzing does raise a number of waiver issues here, because I think that having declined to challenge any of the merits decisions reached in the intermodal order, it is, I think, difficult to separate the substantive arguments out for the petitioner's case here. The FCC...
It's hard in both ways, right? Because the FCC shouldn't get an advantage from having erred by not giving its explanations earlier.
Well, I'm not sure that it giving us an advantage, because...
Well, if the explanations you offer now, I'm not saying they are, but if it were the case that the explanations you offer now are unreasonable or don't seriously consider alternatives or arbitrary and capricious, the other side shouldn't be disadvantaged by the fact that they didn't know you were going to have bad explanations earlier.
I agree with that as a concept, Judge Garland, but I think if you go back and you actually look at the intermodal order and you look at paragraph 40 of that order, this is at page 58 of the joint appendix, and I'll give you a moment to...
I have it.
Okay. So starting in paragraph 39, actually, you have NTCA saying that there's disproportionate transport costs placed on rural carriers, and so please don't impose this burden on us until you've figured out all the transport issues. And in other words, they're asking the agency to give them an alternative, avenue of relief on the merits as a substantive matter. And the commission says no. It says we're not going to do this. We have considered your request, and we are reaching the determination here that transport costs, these rating and routing issues, are not really part of this proceeding, because they're not directly caused by number porting itself, and they go beyond the scope of this matter. And so we reach a substantive determination that we're taking this issue off the table for purposes of determining how what the effect is of these things on you. And I think that that was their opportunity to challenge this on its merits. And so for that reason, Judge Garland, I think that it takes this case out of the hypothetical that you and I agreed upon, which is that had they not had the opportunity, I think it would be unfair for me to say, well, they blew it and now they can never do it, even though they never had an opportunity. But because they did, what they're trying to do now is to have a second bite at the apple. And I think that's actually unfair to the FCC rather than unfair to the petitioner in this case. Because, after all, they could have raised all of these challenges at the time of the original order. And that goes also for other requested avenues of relief, such as requiring a point of interconnection in every rural rate center. And the commission explicitly considered that. And it also said, again, this is in the intermodal order.
Paragraph 27.
And it said in, I've just lost my place, but it considered that and it said, yes, here we are in paragraph 27 at JA 54, limiting wireline to wireless porting to rate centers where there's a point of interconnection would deprive the majority of wireline consumers of the ability to port their number. In other words, we're reaching a substantive public policy determination here, and it's going against giving specific relief to small carriers.
So those are on both of those two issues. On this question of the cost, you say all the costs are recoverable. They say they're not. When you're talking about all the costs, you're not talking about transport costs or?
No. There are two different types of costs involved.
So you have a footnote that says, I think the language says something like although they're not all directly recoverable, they're all recoverable.
Some of the costs
are. Some that are not recoverable at all?
No. All the costs are recoverable through the rates at one point or another. Some of the costs, the implementation costs, in other words, the kind of fixed startup costs, are recoverable over a five-year period on a explicitly stated charge on the telephone bill, federally required local number portability charge. You probably have it on your phone bill at home.
I could understand that.
and then there are other charges that are just costs of doing business. I mean, just like every other cost of doing business that get factored into the rate of return. And most rural carriers, maybe all of them, are regulated rate of return carriers, and they are essentially guaranteed a established rate of return at the federal level. For access purposes, they are guaranteed an 11.25% rate of return on their investment. And you calculate that return by figuring out what their total expenses are and what their revenue is.
I suppose their argument is if you drive up the price too much by doing that, people stop using the wireline.
Well, you know, there are, particularly in rural areas, there are universal service subsidies that are intended to keep the costs of rural wireline service down. Also, you know, not the fixed cost, but the marginal cost, the variable costs, you have the wireless carriers who face the same cost issues as the rural carriers. Every time, if a call goes one way, there may be a transport cost imposed on one person, but if a call goes the other way, there's an equal transport costs imposed.
Ask about
on the
one
other
cost in particular. So I just want to understand the FCC's approach to this. So the rural carriers say there are very few of their subscribers who really want to do this.
That's correct.
Right. So let's just accept this for the moment that
sure.
There are very few. Obviously, if there are very many, you have an argument about the public interest. But if there are only a few, and the implementation cost, even for one, is enormously high because you have to establish the point of interconnection and everything, even if it's only one, is your position that as long as there are only a few, that they will get a waiver, or that's when a waiver is available,
well,
and therefore they won't have any costs?
I think, well, there's two arguments about the costs. And in terms of implementation, I think that the commission's assessment was that the implementation costs would not, in fact, be that high. You know, 20 cents a line per month for a couple of years. And the commission has a discussion
about the fact it's not that big a deal because there aren't going to be very many. And I'm unclear about what that means. I understood that to mean.
Are you talking about in the brief?
No, in the regulatory flexibility analysis.
Well, if the The commission...
Now, you also say it in the brief. I think that's right.
Well, with respect to the transport cost, what we said in the brief is that if there's no demand for this, if it turns out that there's no demand for this, then there will correspondingly be no transport costs.
I guess it's the implementation costs.
Right. But the implementation costs are the very costs that the commission assessed and found that in the main there would not be a significant burden imposed by implementation.
Go with me on the question of waiver here. So when do they get a waiver? If only two subscribers really want to port, do they have to spend all the money necessary for implementation, or would that be a likely waiver case?
I think the likely waiver case would not be so much on the demand side, but the cost side. In other words, if they could show that their particular costs of implementation were excessively high, I don't know what that number is, but let's say $10 per line per month, then the commission or a state commission could say, yeah, that's too high, we'll give you a waiver. But in terms of the demand side of things.
Let's say it was $10 a month or $5 a month, but only one subscriber wanted that, and this would impose that cost on everybody in the area.
If it's 20 cents a month and it imposes that, and it's only one customer, I think the theory here is that implicit in your question is the notion that the only person that benefits from the number porting is the person who's actually porting his number. But the theory that the commission is operating on here is that the availability of porting, the availability of competition, benefits all subscribers, and it benefits all subscribers in a number of different ways. If the incumbent LEC, which after all is a historical monopoly, is facing the prospect of competition, the incumbent LEC may improve its service. It may provide friendlier representatives. It may do any number of the things that competition leads to, and that benefits everybody. That doesn't just benefit the one person who ports his number. And so the fact is that moving from a monopoly market to a competitive market imposes costs, but it does that for a larger benefit, and the benefits come in the form of, in the longer term, better service, better rates, better availability. And, you know, it's not necessarily something that an incumbent monopolist likes to have happen, but Congress has decided that this is an important public policy and that everybody benefits from competition, not just those people who choose to port their numbers. And so I think that that's why it would not necessarily be that the waiver analysis turns on the number of customers who ask for porting, but rather on the costs that are imposed. And if there were excessive costs imposed, then the FCC or a state commission might say, yeah, that's too high.
But aren't those costs ultimately cost per subscriber?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Aren't those costs ultimately realized as costs per subscriber?
That's correct. Per line, per month.
How can you separate the number of subscribers from whether the cost is excessive?
I think I understood Judge Garland's question to refer to the number of subscribers that actually requested porting as opposed to the total customer base.
Who pays for the whatever cost is incurred?
That's
paid for by all of the customers.
By all of the customers, that's right. I think that's because, as I was saying before, all of the customers benefit from the availability of porting, from the prospect of competition. Anybody could port their number, and everybody will benefit if an incumbent monopolist changes its practices in a way that makes it a better, more consumer-friendly organization.
Ask you one legal question. There is a provision in the public law, which is the one that cited in some of the opinions, which says that agencies, I guess it's Section 2B of the public law, which of the RFA, which says agencies are required to solicit and consider flexible regulatory proposals and to explain the rationale for their actions to assure that such proposals are given serious consideration.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the codified section,
mm-hmm.
I guess. I guess my first question is, do you have any idea why it's hanging out there by itself? And second, do the words serious consideration imply a substantive element more than just a procedural element?
Well,
if not, what does it mean?
Okay. In terms of your first question, I can't answer that. And this isn't our statute, so yeah. I don't know actually who codifies these.
Nobody's statutes.
But in terms of the serious consideration, I think that it implies an intent of Congress that these things be looked at seriously, but Congress was also, in many other sections of the public law, quite clear that it was not imposing a substantive...
Does it require more than the APA?
I certainly don't think that it can require more than the APA, and I don't think that the courts, including this court, has...
Does it require the same as the APA?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that it could require the same as the APA. You alluded to some cases that equated the APA standard.
Well, we've used the word reasonable consideration.
That's right, a good faith, reasonable. And I think that that's language that is very consistent with the APA standard. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you can interpret any of those things as going beyond what the APA requires. And you know, there are certain doctrines under the APA,
well, I don't
like
think
hard
your
look.
Opponents are arguing that it should go beyond either. I think they're only arguing that it be as much as the APA.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, the order that you have before you, to the extent that it's just a procedural matter, if you look at the court's cases involving consideration of issues, and this is what Judge Kavanaugh was referring to earlier, if the FCC is required to consider an issue, I think that we clearly passed that test here. We considered these issues. We considered these issues in multiple places, and we've come to the same answer every time we've considered these issues. I don't think that you can say that there's been any failure of process here. The RFA entitles the petitioner to an analysis, a consideration, a good faith effort, and I think that we have done all those things. They don't like what we've done. They don't like the substantive outcome here. But I think the cases and the statute itself are both quite clear that you don't get a substantive outcome under the RFA. You're not guaranteed any particular relief. All you're guaranteed is an analysis. And I think the committee has done that here. And so if there are no further questions, we would urge the court to affirm.
Bill Ward, you need a minute?
Your Honor, the FCC's claim that its rule somehow promotes competition is not supported by the record. In less than 1% of wireless customers have ported their landline telephone number, and we discussed that in our reply brief at page 14. In addition, the demand for wireline to wireless porting has decreased from 4.9% to 3.04% since this rule was enacted. I'd also like to address the transport issue that counsel mentioned. Even though the commission did deal with the merits of transport in the intermodal order, the point here is that what it did when it considered transport in the RFA, it used its deferral of a decision on transport as an excuse for not determining whether transport costs are significant. And the record shows that they are significant. Being no further questions.
Thank you, Ellen.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with them on the other side when they say that all of your costs are ultimately recoverable? I had the understanding from your briefs that you don't agree with that. Are they ultimately recoverable?
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't agree with that. Certainly transport costs are not recoverable in the context of what has been ordered by the FCC here. Carriers have to eat those costs.
What about on the sort of rate of return?
Recoverable
through the rate of return.
That's a bit of a more complicated issue, because what the FCC has got is a rule that says that carriers have to recover their carrier-specific LNP costs over a five-year period. They recover query administration charges in a tariff charge and query dip charges in a tariff charge as well. So that to the extent that those costs are not recovered in that five-year period, there is no way that I know of that they can be recovered.
But can they be recovered in the five-year period? That's the part I wasn't understanding.
Well, to the extent that they're in, I don't know whether they can all be recovered.
I think his implication was he raise your rates in order to get this 11.2 or some percentage profit, that you would do that over 5 years. You don't know.
It's not a matter of raising rates, Your Honor. Uh-huh. It is a carrier-specific charge that is passed on to the customer.
Mm-hmm. But you say you don't know if you can recover it, but you don't have any doubt that you can pass it on, isn't that right?
The LNP charge, there's no doubt that can be passed on. That's right. The carrier the rate that is the monthly rate based on implementation costs can be recovered. The same is not true of transport costs.
That's what I was asking, but not
correct.
About the transport costs.
That's right.
All right, so with the transport costs, the five-year period is just not applicable?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, the carriers have no way of recovering those costs because the point of what the commission said was that it was not going to create an alternative that would provide for carriers to recover those transport costs from other carriers.
But what about from your subscribers? At least until they figure out what they're going to do about these.
Well, they're inter-carrier costs. So how do you recover those from your subscribers?
I am confused, I have to admit. I understood that they are inter-carrier costs, so they're money you have to pay. That's money that reduces your profitability. Since you're entitled to a rate of profitability, the way to recover it would be to charge more to your subscribers. That's not doable? I mean, that's not a way in which cost for the company can be recovered.
Well, you know, as you well know, Judge Garland, because you've written this.
I wrote the other one.
Right? Yeah. But I mean, there's the interstate jurisdiction and there's the intrastate jurisdiction. So where exactly do these costs belong?
Further questions? No.
There being no further questions, I would request that the court reinstitute the stay that it had instituted and remand the case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sussman. No. Marcus, thank you. The case is submitted.
Tell Mr. Sussman he got thanked twice.
Yes.